So we're going to begin with the two, not all of the final poems, but two of the final poems. I want us to get another additional taste of Shir Shirim. And from there, we're going to, of course, have some musical interludes, and also go further in discussing the metaphors and the take homes that we can take from Shir Shirim, those that have been suggested since medieval times, and also a number of modern ideas. Okay, so without further ado, we have two other final poems that I would like us to learn together. The first is the poem really from the last chapter in Shir Shirim of chapter 8. And it starts with an exclamation. It starts with an exclamation that is not technically part of the poem itself, but it's understood to be a declaration of, wow, look at this dod and this re'aya with the poem that comes right after it. Mizot olam min hamidbar mitrapeket al doda. Okay, who is this woman? Okay, without saying woman, who is this woman that comes up from the desert? We saw this phrase earlier in Shir Shirim, who is leaning on her dod, which in this case means something like fawning, mitrapek from the word like melpek, which we derive from that to mean elbow. Okay, so who is this? Who is this couple, right? Who is this couple before us? And again, it's an exclamation. Maybe it's meant to be directed at the Benot Yerushalayim. And it goes as follows: Tachat ha'tapuach orartiha, shama chibaltcha imecha, shama chibla yeladetcha. And so we have here the woman is speaking, as you see, the purple, the woman is speaking the entire time. And she again refers to the tapuach. The tapuach is mentioned four times throughout Shir HaShirim. And it's mentioned four times throughout Shirim. It clearly was loved by the writer of these poems, by Shlomo HaMelech or whoever else might have written it. And the tapuach is something that has a good smell when it's growing. It's crisp. It has obviously wonderful taste. And the tapuach here is noted as the place under which the dod was conceived. Okay, and again, it's not the first time that we've had references to these overt references to conception, which we wouldn't think are particularly romantic notions, but clearly for this audience, they had a different connotation. And underneath that tapuach, underneath that apple tree, you have been awakened. And here, the image again, there are multiple ways to interpret it. I'm always giving you one interpretation, but there are many that here it seems as if she's nudging him, okay? That he's underneath an apple tree. Again, metaphorically, he's underneath an apple tree and she's nudging him. She's waking him up. She's waking him up because she can't hold herself back because she wants to be close to him. And she notes that the apple tree is the place where you were conceived by your mother. And again, another phrase to mean the same thing. There you came into being. Simeni kechotam al libecha, kechotam al zroecha. Okay, put me, place me as an insignia on your heart and on your arm. That an insignia, a chotam. Sorry, you hear my children screaming. We moved up the hour 1 hour, so therefore I have children who are still awake. Hopefully, my husband will get that under control soon. So she says that the chotam, the insignia ring, usually in those times, but it was worn as a necklace. It was basically the same parallel to your tudat zehut as we have in Israel, sort of your passport, your identity card. And she says, make me your identity card, right? Be with me, be together with me. Ki aza chamavet ahava, kasha ki sheol kin'ah. And here she describes, and I want us to see this poem because these psukim get used often. Okay, they're the psukim that come up, particularly the last, sorry, particularly pasuk zayin, and she says here that love is as strong or is as mighty as death. Kasha ki sheol kin'ah. Sheol is the is supposed to be parallel to the word mavet. It is the reference in Tanakh to the underworld, which really reflected a real belief. Not in we talk about people going up to Shemaim, but in Tanakh, sorry, in Tanakh they spoke about people going down into the underworld. And that it's as harsh, but again, here not harsh in a bad way, but it's as strong and powerful as Sheol. Kin'ah here likely doesn't mean jealousy, but that it's referring to also something that is Qin'at here is understood to be a parallel for love. Okay. And so here she's speaking to the strength of it. And now she's going to add an image to how strong love can be. We're going to talk about it in a minute, the impact of this image. Okay. Now the word reshef is doesn't appear in other places in Tanakh. Later on in Chazal, it appears to actually mean a spark. And so it's understood to be similar to fire. Some translate it as bows, like we talk about like Cupid's bows. Or perhaps meaning some sort of coals, but again, it's something hot, okay, or it's the heat of the fire. Shalhevet ya, and here it's still describing love, and shalhevet means a flame, and shalhevet ya in some of our earliest copies of Shir Shirim, it appears as two words, shalhevet ya, which means the flame of God. But in most of them, it appears as shalhevet ya, which what do you call what ends suffix? A suffix of yud hey doesn't necessarily mean God in Tanakh, but it means great or big. It appears in many other places where we use the God's name to symbolize how big and powerful something is. And so here, love is being described as fire, which I think you'll all understand is a complex image. Right, fire comes. It takes over very quickly. It can also be put out, but it is very stubborn. It's not safe. Fire is not a safe image. It's a threatening image, but it does describe the image of early stages of love, perhaps when people just literally get lit on fire, right? All the oxytocin and all that and all that goodness, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Shelhevet Yah, if you look at it as Shelhevet Yah, the flame of God, that already softens the image of love. It underscores the fact that love is heaven sent, which I think echoes many people's experience when they fall in love, which this poem is clearly describing an earlier stage of love, as is really all of Shir Shirim, that it's a sense that, oh my goodness, I can't believe this happened to me. I can't believe, and if those of us with a religious worldview, I certainly can remember for myself that when I finally met a person that I said, wow, this person is going to be my spouse, which of course for all of us, it doesn't happen necessarily in that way, but it was a real feeling. I would say one of my strongest feelings in my life of Hashgacha Pratit, of divine providence, that of all the people in the world, of all the people who sit around waiting for years and all the difficulty that can entail. I remember this feeling, you know, other people describe it as stars aligning for a person. I said a moment of Hashgacha, right? A moment where everything aligned in the right place and you really feel like the world is shining down on you. That's oxytocin. And if you're a realist person and you feel that, wow, God really tipped his hat off to me, and this is quite an unbelievable gift. And I think that that is one of the ways to think about shelhevet yah, if you look at it as two separate words. Again, the flame of God, whereas the other interpretation is that it means a large flame. And then it sort of brings us back to the threatening image of the quick overcoming that people feel when they fall in love, but also the ability for it to be put out very quickly and for it to be destructive if not contained in the proper way. Mayim rabim lo yuchlu lechabot et ha'ava u'neharot lo yishtefuha. Mighty waters, mayim rabim, those of you who were in the class before, mayim rabim is a phrase that also appears in Tehillim. That the mightier waters cannot put out love, right? And so when we talk about love as fire, but the next pasuk immediately says, but don't worry, it's not the kind of fire that can immediately be put out by throwing water in it. It's the kind of fire that's stubborn. It's the kind of fire that will take a superhuman effort, that will take hordes and hordes of firefighters to possibly put it out. This is a strong love and it's a stubborn love. And also rivers cannot overflow it. I'm sorry, cannot... lost my English by the end of the day. Sorry about that. Imiten ish et kol hon beto be'ava, boz yavozu lo. And if somebody would even think to take all of their estate and to use it and to pay for love, right? That's a terrible idea. Meaning there is no way that somebody could ever pay in monetary value the worth of true love. And this is a poem that very clearly describes the strength of love. I think it describes a little bit the strength of a certain kind of love, the strength of an earlier love. I think that other images would be used to describe more mature love. But it's that feeling, I would say, in the earlier stages of falling in love, where nothing can break this. This is heaven sent. This is exactly what's meant to be. And it's a very important feeling because you know what it gets us to do? Get married. Otherwise, we might not do that. Stop. There are other reasons people get married, but that's what evolutionary biologists point to as really the biological function of the sense of falling in love. Otherwise, people wouldn't do things like get married and have children. Because later on you get a little bit too smart and your brain is a little bit more higher functioning. So in any event, that I think is one way to look at this poem. I want us to see this midrash, which some of you might be familiar with, but kol kach karov lePesach, I couldn't not bring this midrash. Tachat haTapuach Oraticha, Darash Rabbi Avera. Sorry, that should be Rabbi Zera, I think. I'm not sure if that's a typo. Okay, because in the merit of righteous women, we were set out of Mitzrayim. By the way, without looking at any Midrashim, the plain shot of that concept in Chazal is Perek Bet in Sefer Shmot. All the women who gathered together to save Moshe Rabbeinu, that is the basic shot of that concept. We can go further and look at all the Midrashim about women, which this will tell us in one moment. But that pshat is, sorry, that Midrash is describing the unbelievable reality in the Psukim in Sefer Shmot. Very often Chazal are describing a reality in the Psukim. Sometimes we have to work a little bit harder to figure it out, but that's very clearly Shmot Perek Bet is the impact those women have on Moshe, on his life, on saving him, and also later on in his life, which is a different idea. The impact of women on Moshe and how that we see that coming up later in his leadership in the desert. What is this midrash referring to? These women in Mitzrayim, shehayu mishtadlot lehizakek, and here it's referring almost backhandedly to the story that is also recorded in Shmot Rabbah in Pisgah Bet, there where we have again the story we're familiar with that we almost forget that it's not inside the Torah itself, that the husbands wanted to separate from their wives, or they separated from their wives, and it wasn't until Amram and Yocheved got back together that they all started to get back together. They were scared if they would be living together as a married couple and be having sexual relations, they would have children who would then be killed. And so they said, better that we should separate from each other than we should have children who will die. Again, the kind of scene that literally played out again in the Holocaust in all different ways that we would think for 2,000 years that nothing like that would happen again. But that's the scene that is being described in the Midrash. But here we have already the reference to the reuniting, that the women insisted on getting back together with their husbands, and they insisted that the Jewish people will continue. Somehow it'll work out. And when they had to go give birth, but they couldn't go give birth in their homes or in, perhaps they were birthing centers, stop, giving birth in their homes, they went out to the Sadeh. And so the Midrash says that where did they go? They went out to the apple trees. And so this pasuk from the previous poem that we just saw is referring to the fact that they would go again in the metaphor, in the historical metaphor, which we'll recap for ourselves a little bit later, that this is where they would give birth. And so in the poem, it's referring to the miraculous rebirth of Am Yisrael that would happen in the field, that was there happening in the fields to save the children, hopefully, from being killed by the Egyptians. Okay. I want us to see the final poem. I've skipped two in the middle. Again, everyone, please, you can look through Shir HaShirim. I'll encourage you to read it even more so to go through with any pirush that feels comfortable for you. And see, I really think that the poems I've brought you give you a very strong taste of Shir HaShirim, but again, in a class of five, I've chosen for you. And so I want us to see the last two psukim, which form the final poem, because it really gets already to this question of what is the purpose of Shir HaShirim? What is the message? Both in the pshat sense, and we're going to get very deep into the metaphorical sense as well. And I think that we really need to end off where Shir HaShirim ends as well. As you see, it's divided again. The green is the dod, is the male, and the purple is the ra'ya. Hayoshevet baganim, chaverim makshivim lekolech hashmi'ini. And I'm sure many of you remember that this already repeats a few motifs that we saw two classes ago. And he calls her she who sits in the garden. And he says, there are my friends, or there are others who are listening to your voice. Let us hear your voice. But let us hear your voice, either speaking or singing. And here again, we have these chaverim, if you remember that they came in by the wedding scene. But he says, we all want to hear you, right? We all want to hear your beautiful voice. And what is her response to him? Her response is as follows: Brach dodi udemelecha letzvi. And her response to him is, go away for now. Okay, go away, run away, like the tzvi and the ayal, and right, the gazelle and the deer. And where should you go? You should go to Hare Besamim, to the mountain of spices. Now, there are a number of ways to interpret this pasuk, right? Like all good biblical passages, it's not clear. And so there are a number of ways to interpret this. I would say the most forgiving way to interpret this pasuk, which is the way that many of our classical parshanim interpret it, and I'll explain why I think in a moment, is they say, well, she says to him, I don't want to hang out with you. I don't want to go on a date with you when all your friends are around. Go away for a little while. And go to Hare Besamim. But who is the mountain of spices? It's her, right? She's been described, right? That was the whole scene. Ariti Morim Divshi, right? Describing her as the mol and the kalkum and all the different spices that she would immerse herself in. And so Hare Besamim must be a metaphor for her body. And it still points, by the way, to the fact that there's a very early stage in the relationship, right? That he's still hanging out with his friends and they're not just them, the two of them together. Shir Shirim ends with, I would say, a relatively youthful, immature poem. And that's one interpretation. And most of the Parshanim interpret it that way because of how they, I would say, how they are swayed regarding the metaphor. Because they want, in the metaphor that they offer, for the dod and the ra'ayah to unite at the end. They don't want it to end with them separating. And so that definitely has a clear impact on how they interpret it. We'll see Rashi, for example. You know what? I'll show you Rashi right now. And then we'll come back. Rashi says as follows. Hayoshevet baganim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu omer leKnesset Yisrael, right? The man is speaking to the woman, God in this metaphor is speaking to Am Yisrael. At hanefutza bagola, you who are spread out in the diaspora, ro'e baganim shel acherim, ro'a, sticha baganim shel acherim, you are grazing in the fields, sorry, in the gardens of others, right? Again, notice how the words are being reinterpreted. V'yoshevet bebatei knesiot u'midrashot, and you're sitting in your shuls and your bate midrash. Chaverim makshivim lekolech. Who are these friends listening to your voice? Malachei asharet chavereich, bnei Elohim. Who is listening? Who are these friends? They're the angels. They're those who are watching over you. And this also refers to a theology, which is that God doesn't have direct hashgacha outside of Israel, but that he sends his messengers to watch over Am Yisrael. It's a theology that comes from Pasuk and Dvarim, and that really gets elaborated on. And how does the end interpreted? Brach dodi min hagola hazot ufadino mi binehem. He says, what does it mean to run away? He says, run away from this galut. Udomer lecha letzvi lemaher hageula vehashra al hare besamim hu hara moria uveit hamikdash sheibaneh b'mehera b'yamenu. He says, what is this mountain that I want you to run to? God, right? She's speaking to the dod. I want you to run. I want you to hear to run away. He interprets that to hurry up. I want you to hurry up the geula and to meet me on Har HaMoriah, which is the Har Basamim. Okay, the temple site is the mountain of spices. And so there's a separating, but it's a separation in order to reunite. And that's how many interpret this verse. But I want us to look for a moment, okay? When she says run away, it means run away. It means go away. Even if she means we should reunite, she's pushing him away. She's not pulling him close. She's not celebrating their love in public. And I also want us to remember that this phrase parallels an earlier phrase that we saw in Perek Bet. That there, I'll just read the last pasuk. It says, when that was a, it was a sad moment that we all saw together, where she pushes him away, really, right? And she says, no, there's these shualim, there's these foxes. And she says, wait, I want the day to pass, and I want you to go away. Al harei vater. And there, harei vater is from the word betarim, to be separated, right? Go away for now. She was very clearly not ready there. And so the parallel with harei vater, so here it's har besamim. So there are those that say it's a lot less strong, right? Har besamim is a much closer image than telling someone to go to the mountains of separation. It's the mountains of spices. It's not separating, which is possibly true. But on the other hand, she is saying, go for now. Right? I'm not totally with you. And I think that we often want to see happy endings. That, by the way, is also very culturally based. North American cultures are stronger in this one than European and certainly Israeli culture. We really want to see happy endings. But Shir Shirim doesn't really provide us with that necessarily. Again, there are those who read it more sympathetically. I'm a little bit more sympathetic to the reading of go away for now, right? Maybe we'll reunite later, but I'm still playing hard to get. I'm still in this game where we keep missing each other, where we're not really, you know, it didn't end with the poem that we just saw before this. It ends with this one. And that is how Shir Shirim ends. It ends with the phrase Har Besamim, which has, you can almost smell the Besamim when you say that phrase, but it's not the idyllic image. It's not even the most idyllic image that we have in Shir Shirim. Now, I'm going to address that on all levels, on the metaphoric level, on the level between a couple. But before we do that, I want to take a musical break. And I brought you someone new in this context. Some of you may be familiar with them because before Corona, they did try and go around all over North America. And so I brought you Yonina. Yonina, they're a really cute couple. Actually, my husband, he was in the army with Yoni, with the husband here. And they're a really sweet couple, and they are trying to make themselves sort of like a little folk band. She writes a lot of the music. He writes a lot of the music. If you're not familiar with them, check them out. They have a lot of really, really great songs. They have a few in English as well. Their parents are Anglos, so they both speak English. And here we have a song, one of the first songs. I will say that she is singing. It's interesting. Statement in and of itself, she's totally from woman, and not going to go into halacha, but everyone make whatever decisions they want. They're singing together in this video, and I brought it for you. The song is about falling in love, a really beautiful description that she wrote, I believe, when she met her husband. And in the end, there's the quote of Maim Rabim lo yuchlu lichbot ad ahava v'na'arot lo yishtefua. And that's the end of the song. And she speaks about how love overtakes us and that it grabs us without even us realizing. And one day our world looks one way and then the next day looks totally different. It's a beautiful song that describes the early stages of a love relationship. And in that way, I think it really mirrors a lot of Shir Shirim. Here they are. They're so sweet. Just nod in a second if you can hear it. You should be able to. You hear, right? Yeah. Speaking to love,
Amen.
Okay, they're like as sweet as vanilla ice cream. Their music is so young. I mean, everybody's careers have basically, stopped in a ridiculous way. Obviously, people in music. I really hope that they'll regain traction because they were doing really well. They hadn't yet made it on the main radio station here, but I was really rooting for them. They have some great music. She's a wonderful writer. Her writing is really, really beautiful, and I'm always amazed. My kids love this song. They put out a song, two songs that they made a version in English and Hebrew, and I'm so in awe of that ability to write the song well in both languages. They had a cute little song about a kid wanting to go outside, and it was very much connected to Corona. My kids love it. Anyways, check them out. Their kids show up in their videos. They have two little children. Okay, I'm sorry that I can't check the chat at the same time, but it makes everything jump. So, and there it goes. Hold on 1 second. On. Okay. Sorry about that. The videos make everything jump. Okay. So, that completes the portion of our evening where we're speaking about the poems themselves. I want to end in the next half hour we have together. I want to end our series looking at broader issues. I want to look at the Re'aya as a female figure in Tanakh and just get a little bit of perspective on how she fits in or what she adds or fills in the picture of women in Tanakh. And I also then, of course, want to move a little bit deeper into the metaphor vis-a-vis how it works with the pshat. Okay, and you understand what I mean as we go through. I want, before I say anything about women in Tanakh, I want to say a very, very clear statement, which is that there is no prototype of women in Tanakh. Tanakh does a phenomenal job depicting the women of its time, many of whom were really largely invisible and secondary citizens. It does a wonderful way of depicting women as varied. There are female leaders. There are women who are smart and who are known as Isha Chachama. There are women who do heroic things. And there are women who were women in ancient society. And I think that Tanakh does a very, very wonderful job of depicting the varied roles that women were able to fill while also being very true to its time. That's a little bit of response to a lot of feminist academia that I just always, it frustrates me. It's just very out of place. It just takes something out of its historical context. But I want to just compare the Ra'iyah with two other women in Tanakh. Why? Two other women in Tanakh. Okay. And one of them is the woman in Mizmor 128, a phrase that many of us may be familiar with. Ishtecha kegefen. Here it's talking about the blessed man. Okay, and among the things that the blessed man is blessed with is if of course he works hard, right? Meaning here to cultivate food and land, he works hard, and in fact he gets what he cultivates, that he's able to see the fruits of his labors. Ve'ishtecha kegefen poria. Your wife is a fruitful vine, of course, referring to her ability to procreate. And Bialketebetecha here usually is referred to as the inside of the house, meaning she's fruitful, but she stays in the inside. And your children, your sons, are like plants around your table. Again, referring to her as a fertile person, her as her children as her fruit. The point that I want to take from here is simply that the woman here is very clearly framed as being a mother, right? Her role is to be a mother and to procreate. And that I'm not going to go into the exact image of all the pieces, but that's the image here. And what I want us to think about as we look at these images is that the woman that we know from Shir, that we know from Shir Shirim, the Ra'aya, she's passionate. She is loving. She's also scared and sometimes immature, but she expresses herself and she wants intimacy. She's a woman at a different stage of life. She's not a mother. And I want us to see one more image of a woman. Let's all pray it doesn't go crazy here. Yay. Okay. And that's Eshet Chayil. Now, I'm not going to do a whole analysis of Eshet Chayil. Eshet Chayil, for those who aren't familiar with, I didn't write it on here, comes from Mishlei, Perek Lamed Aleph. It's the last Perek in Mishlei. And within the context of Mishlei, Eshet Chayil is a very interesting character because Mishlei came to talk about all these different bad women, okay? All these women who will take men off their proper path and women who are overly sexual. And Eshet Chayil comes to be she's described as the ideal woman within the context of Mishlei, right? We take it also and speak about her on, we sing about her on Friday night, but that's the context in Sefer Mishlei. She's the antithesis of the other kinds of women, of the seductress and of the woman who was going to make others fail, and of the woman who was too smart. And there's what to say here. It is a certain depiction of women. I'm not, whitewashing that, but the woman in Eshet Chayil is many things. Okay. She is many, many things. She is also the one who takes care of things in her house. She whips everything into shape to then enable her husband to be at the Sha'al Ha'ir, okay, to go out to the gates of the city. Her children praise her, meaning she's not doing everything and she's not the neck or the enabler and everyone forgets about her. She is given praise, right? If you see Kamuvanavia, right? Everybody praises her for her hard work. And she has chokhmah, chesed. She's a very active woman. She's very busy. She's a very busy woman. She makes me very dizzy. When I actually sit and think and listen to the song when they sing it on Friday night, I think I don't really want to be the Eshet Chayil. I want to take many more rests than she does. She's a very busy woman. And there are a number of things here that really come as a real antithesis to what we see in Shir HaShirim. If you remember, of course, the song that's most often made into the pasuk that's most often made into songs is Sheker Pasuk Lamed, Sheker Achen VeHevel HaYofi, right? Beauty is nothing. Beauty is vaporous. It disappears. yes, dissipates. Disapparate is in Harry Potter. It dissipates. Isha yirat Hashem hi titalal, right? A woman who fears God, she is the one who we will, who we praise. And the woman in Shir HaShirim is beautiful. And she, I'm sure that Eshel Chayil is beautiful, but in Shir HaShirim, nobody is concerned about overpraising her. No one, I mean, I skipped over, I have to say, I skipped over some of the more overtly erotic descriptions of her body, which come in Perek Zayin. But she is beautiful, and she's praised for her body. I don't really hear anything in Shir HaShirim about her relationship with God, to be quite honest. And again, this is where Chazal says the danger of looking too closely at the Pshat. But I'm just speaking up at the image itself of the woman. In Shir HaShirim, she's being praised by her dod. And there also is and she has here a relationship with a spouse, but she has all these children. And of course, the difference is accounted for by the fact that this is a woman at a different stage of life. That the woman, the re'aya, it's ironic because re'aya means a wife in Hebrew. It's like, it means wifey, actually. If you say re'aya, it's like the most dowdy term you could say in Hebrew, really, for a wife. Stam, it's sweet, but it doesn't mean lover anymore. It means wifey. And so the woman in Shir HaShirim, some like to say that she's liberated and that she is unfettered, which is a little bit of a simplistic interpretation because she has all these threatening male figures that also show up in the background. She has the Shomrim, she has her brothers, and so it's not totally true, but certainly it's a young woman. It's a young woman who is totally unshackled. And of course, we all know that once a woman gets married, so now she has in her inner sphere her husband's needs, who she's constantly worrying about. We can debate from today till tomorrow if this is a social construct, if it's biology. And then once she has her children, she's constantly flirting around for w with her children. And so I want us first to see that there are different models of women in Tanakh. And I, like I said in the first lesson, it would be very amiss if there wasn't that woman who was described in Shir HaShirim, again, before I'm getting to the metaphor, that who wasn't described as the one who's falling in love, who's being intimate, who is expressing her sexual desire openly. I think that that fills in a very, very important space, and that, we see women later and they're having children and they're heads of households, but that woman in Shir HaShirim is every woman as well. And it would be, I think, really amiss if Chazal didn't include that model in it. So I think that is, again, of the many contributions of Shir HaShirim, even just within the concept of women in Tanakh. Now, I want us to move in the last portion of our evening to talk about the metaphors, but we're going to be talking about the metaphors as it relates to the Pshat. Okay, so it's going to be woven in together. Now, first, I want to talk about not the metaphor I've spoken about until now, but the metaphor of the gun, of the garden. There are only two gardens described in all of Tanakh. The first one is the Garden of Eden, and the second one is the woman as a garden in Shir HaShirim. Now, and there's only two gardens that are described in Tanakh as being locked. After we get expelled from Gan Eden, after Adam and Chava get expelled from Gan Eden, it's locked and never be re-entered. And she is described, if you remember, as a Gan Na'ul, Achoti Kala, right? You are a locked garden. There we spoke about it, referred to her, possibly her virgin state, possibly her just being not open to connection. But it's striking. Okay, it's a striking parallel. There are many, many parallels between the two stories. If you would like to read more, I don't necessarily espouse every part of her interpretation, but if you Google Yael Ziegler, Dr. Yael Ziegler, she has an article, I believe it's on Hatzarach, which is her website, where she speaks more about her interpretation of Gan Eden and Shir HaShirim. And there's definitely audio sharing that you can look at. I just want to speak about a few small points. If you remember, again, speaking to this parallel, I think it's striking. It's really striking and it shouldn't be ignored. And whenever we see a parallel, we have to see what possibly could the parallel offer us on a message level, on a deeper level. And on the right side, you just see all the places in Shir Shirim where she's described as a garden. Okay, so I'm not going through every part of this, but you could see it in front of you. And I think there are a number of very important points that well, in Gan Eden, Adam and Chava betrayed their human relationship and the relationship with living things. Okay, their relationship went awry both with the snake, and it went awry between man and woman. Again, I'm not going to go over the details. We'll remember that story. And there are many places throughout Tanakh that create a callback to Gan Eden, to the curses that appear there, not only in Sefer Bereshit, also in Sefer Bereshit, but not only. And many have pointed out that if anything, this loving, young, fresh relationship that is depicted in Shir HaShirim is an antidote or a response to the curse from Gan Eden. And the curse there, it says, Ve'el yishech tshukatech, vehu yimshol bach. And there are many ways to interpret it, but this pasuk, when it's given to the woman as her curse, it creates a hierarchy. Okay, it creates a hierarchy that wasn't there to begin with, that he will be in charge of you. There are those that interpret this minimally, like Rashi, as only in terms of your sexual needs, which in and of itself is we could go there for a long time, what exactly he's referring to. But whatever it is, this pasuk creates a hierarchy where now you will be dependent on your husband and he will have dominance over you. And this is also clearly referring to women's secondary role in society up until the very recent future. But in Shir HaShirim, we have the phrase Anita Dodi V'Dodi Li, which is the most egalitarian, I'll use that phrase on purpose, the most egalitarian phrase of a love relationship that we have anywhere else. I really think certainly in all of Shir HaShirim and also in Tanakh. And so there are many who will look at Shir HaShirim with this relationship where you have the woman is completely vocal and very open about her needs and her emotional needs and her sexual needs, that is a response or a tikkun. Again, I would say on an idea level, on a metaphoric level, to what happens in Gan Eden. Of course, the way that this happens, though, if we want to take Shir HaShirim and the relationship as looking as representing something a little bit deeper than just the early stages of a relationship, in order to maintain this relationship of Anila Dodi V'Dodi Li, it's very nice that you have a leap in the beginning, but master couples who manage to keep that alive for years only keep it alive because they're constantly working at it, because they're constantly reworking and thinking, and they're constantly readjusting, and because they persevere and they have passion. Just yesterday, a kala that I taught, I teach brides before their wedding, and a kala that I taught, and I started a while ago, wishing them what of the things that I wish them. Love is not on the first two of the list. I wish them friendship. I wish them respect, and I also wish them love. But of course, we all know, right? You all again have much more life experience than I do, that those are the keys to a long relationship, and that is what's required in order to keep the phrase Anila Dodi V'Dodi Li to be an honest one that is of two people that are genuinely cherishing each other. So there's definitely a connection there, and there's more to be said about Shir HaShirim Gan Eden, but I wanted to bring that up. And now for our last portion, I want to talk about the metaphor that we've seen in the commentaries that I've also brought. I'm using a division that I saw in Rav Soloveitchik's book that you'll see a quote from in a minute. A division where he said there are two kinds of mashalim. Okay, and there are many different. I said there's also the Kabbalistic mashal, which we haven't gone into at all. But he says there's two ways to look at the metaphor. And here we're moving out of the world of a love relationship, and we're moving into how this relates to a relationship with God, which, as Rav Soloveitchik says, and I believe this is right, that Chazal only believe that that's how Shir HaShirim could be understood. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put it in Tanakh. And he said there's the metaphysical historical, and that is the metaphor that I brought you until now. Like what I brought you with Rashi before, looking at us being in the Galut and God calling us back. He says, according to this interpretation, this metaphor, Excuse me. Shir HaShirim is a duet sung by God and the people, and the examples and the ideas are drawn from our history. And that's everything you saw, the reference to Mitzrayim and the reference to Galut and those are the two that we saw together. So I'll leave it at those two examples. And that is what he calls the metaphysical historical. Metaphysical in the sense that it's our relationship with God, but it's looking at Shir HaShirim as a prism to understand our relationship with God throughout Jewish history. But Rav Soloveitchik elaborates on in his book, Uvikashta Misham, which I believe I mentioned last time, is what he calls the metaphysical universal. Shir HaShirim is a duet sung by God and humankind, expressing mutual longing of creator and created. Meaning it's not about the Jewish people and God. It's about me and Hashem. It's about me, Yosefa Fogel Rubel, and my personal relationship with God. It's not about Moshe, it's not about Mitzrayim. It's about me in the here and now. And that's what I want to focus on for a little bit. I want to focus on that piece. Rav Soloveitchik in his book, if you look at it, he does a rereading of all of Shir HaShirim in the beginning. It's mamash, it's the springboard for the rest of the book. And he says, "What this book, the Shir HaShirim, it's so frustrating. Why can't these two lovers ever be on the same page? They never meet," right? Here, he obviously understands the end the way I think I understand it. And that meaning I understand it the way he understands it. I'll get that order right. He says, "Why can't they ever meet? It's so frustrating. Why do they keep missing each other?" And here I've brought you a little bit of a summary from an article that was written about the book. The Rav describes this ancient song as a metaphor for man's dialectic, which involves both a love and yearning for God and an awe of him. The sages have rendered this give and take as the phrase ratzo v'shov, right? Meaning going back and forth, or two steps forward and three steps back. Sorry, three steps forward, two steps back. I still got that wrong. Mom, you'll have to freshen me up on my English idioms. I've been here for 13 years, too long. Literally running and returning. And the Rav identifies the two poles which drive this relationship. And so the Rav, he's going to define for us what is this to and fro? What are our boundaries? On one hand, human beings seek to generate empirical knowledge through natural scientific methodology, one that is grounded in the measurable universe around us. But this knowledge is limited and contingent by definition. He says, on one hand, we really want to know God by looking at the world around us. Okay, we want to, that we really want to understand the world by looking at the world around us. We want to be able to take a magnifying glass. We want to be able to take a petri dish. We want to be able to have insight into the world around us by looking around and investigating. At the same time, Judaism makes it clear that we are desirous of revelation, meaning the same person who wants to understand this world and wants to be in the here and now, or what I always call with my husband, Olam Hazeh. It's something that I am much less successful at dealing with, is at the same time, Judaism makes it clear that we are desirous of revelation. We also want to be transcendent. And even if we don't feel the urge to be transcendent, our tradition tells us you need to transcend, right? Transcend your food, make it kosher. Transcend your food, make brachot. Transcend your day by making it Shabbat, right? All the mitzvot are all about how to transcend the regular human world, or I would say physical world that we live in. And that is to say transcendental knowledge, which cannot be created by limited man. But we can't be the source of that knowledge because we fit in with nature, with the rest of the world. So God is the source of that knowledge and revelation. It has to come from him. Man strives upward in his desire to taste and experience of the absolute infinite. But in the end, sin separates us from his creator. Now, I'll speak to that for a moment. Our time is waning. But what Rav Soloveitchik says, and again, it's a gross overgeneralization. Please read the book. It's so complex and there's so many pieces to it. But what Rav Soloveitchik says is that we never meet because we want to strive to be close to God. And God actually wants to enable us and let us in. And I would add in here Rav Avram Yoshua Heschel's God's Search for Man, which is a flipping of a phrase that we would think is the opposite, that God looks out for man in the world. And he says that we want to reach God, but we keep missing him. We keep missing him because we sin and because we're limited by the world we live in. And so we want to be transcendent, and our Jewish tradition tells us to be transcendent, but we often don't make it. And that's just one of the ways that Rav Soloveitchik looks at this, and he says that we have a responsibility to constantly strive to reach God, even if we're never really going to make it. And he says many do make it. He says many make it too much, and then they forget the physical world. And the physical world, we have a responsibility to that world as well. But Rav Soloveitchik famously, when he always is talking about poles and dialectics, influenced by the philosophers who were his great his philosophical teachers, but he looks at this and says, this going back and forth of never really fully making it, of getting close, of having intimacy, but then losing it, is a description of our relationship with the divine. Because we're limited. We're limited by the world we live in. We're limited by our sin, which pushes us away from God. And I would add in, though, importantly, that God also reaches out for us, and that God gives us many different openings in the world. And it's a matter of if we take advantage of them. The Rambam, I brought him in our first class. And I brought him in the first class, I brought the quote on the left side in Hilchot Teshuvah, that he says that we learn that, I mean, here he's speaking about how we're supposed to love God. So he's supposed to love God like you would love a lover. He's supposed to be infatuated with God. And he says, and that's what at the end he says, Shlomo Amar derech mashal ki cholat ahava ani, right? That being lovesick, that's what it means. You're supposed to be sick for love with for God. You're supposed to be sick with love for God. But I wanted to look at the right side of the two sources you have in front of you. That what are you supposed to, what does that mean? Because as we've seen from Shirim, is that that's a very specific stage of a relationship. And that Shirim, by the way, the Midrash reflects this idea very nicely when it has a debate, when did Shlomo write Shirim? Did he write it in the beginning of his life, says one opinion? Which would make sense, right? When he's young and naive and idealistic and he falls in love with all these women. Or did he write it when he was old, when he had come to terms with God, according to the Midrash, and was able to love God, even though he had all those other theological issues that he expresses in Kohelet and Mishlei. And so, but that opinion that Shlomo writes it early in life reflects this idea. It's a young, immature love. How, Rambam, how can I ever preserve that throughout a lifetime? It's not realistic. Maybe it's the love of a Baal Tshuva. It's the love of I went to Israel for the year and I couldn't stop learning Torah, but it's not the love that I can maintain when I'm 20, 30, 40 years later. How's that? That's not. And if I constantly say I need to aspire to it, that's very exhausting to always be aspiring to something that I'm never going to actually achieve. And so I think that there are two ways to look at this. One is what the Rambam says on the bottom right. He says, "Lefichach, tzarich ha'adam." He says, "How should you know God that way? How can you achieve that kind of love? Tzarich ha'adam liyached atzmo lehavin ulaskil bechokhmot uutvunot hamodiin lo et kono kefi kocho sheyesh ba'adam lehavin ulasig kama shebe'arnu b'elchot yisrei Torah." So he says, what are you supposed to do? So you're supposed to constantly be learning and pushing yourself, and supposed to try as much as you can with what is within your human capacity to. For the Rambam, understanding God meant to become close to him. That was what brought one close to God in the shadows of Aristotle in Rambam's writing. But I'll say that whatever brings you close to God, okay, maybe it's not trying to delve into the nature of God and deep philosophy. But the Rambam says you have to keep involving and engaging yourself in the relationship. That's the only way you're going to stay in any sort of connected way. And that's very Rambam. The Rambam, you know, in many significant places, talks about the only way to constantly be connected with God and receive Hashgacha Pratit, he says in Moreh Nevuchim, is to constantly engage with God and in learning and trying to know God. Because once you're not engaging with God, He's left you on the streets. Okay, it's a very particular image. I'm not going to go into that right now, but I think that this gives us a tip for how do I sustain a relationship with God. The Rambam says, yeah, hard work every day. Just like your marriage, if you're going to ignore it and you're not going to pay attention to it, it will build up mountains of resentment, will build up mountains of distance. The Rambam says the only way to become close to God and to stay close to God and to stay in love with God is to make a daily effort. Now, I wanted to offer one more piece before we end with hopefully another song we'll have time for, which is that Helen Fisher, who I love, by the way, Google her, listen to interviews with her. She's just really, really fun to listen to. So her official title is a biological anthropologist. She is basically a love scientist, and she has spent most of her life researching love. She has created a lot of the algorithms behind a lot of these matchmaking sites, Cupid.com. She works at the Kinsley Institute, which is an institute for sexual health. And anyway, she's a really interesting woman, and she's also just lovely to listen to. She's older. I believe she's probably at this point in her 70s. It's not old, it's just older. And so she identifies, she did fMRI scans of brains. I mentioned it, I think, in an earlier episode, an earlier lesson. And they identify three main stages of love. Okay. And again, many of us have intuited this over a lifetime. You have the lust stage, which is put forward by certain hormones in our body. Again, it's a biological approach to the stages. It's not hashgacha pratit, and it's not what present was I given. It's a biological approach. Romantic love is the next stage, which is infatuation. And that comes after the initial crave for this person, again, characterized by its own hormones. And the next stage is attachment, which is the I want to be secure, I want to be stable with you. It happens again statistically after the 17 months of a relationship. Usually one moves into the attachment stage, and here we have monogamy, parenthood, and all of those things. And we move into a different stage of life, as many of us are familiar with. And I think that these stages are helpful. There's another stage that's added on the bottom by a different researcher who actually passed away this year of a heart attack. But I think these main three stages are also, they're helpful in framing, because many of us are not in the lust or the romantic stage, which I think is what the Rambam is describing when he speaks about God. Many of us are, on a good day, in the attachment phase. And I think that while it'll be nice to strive for falling in love with someone, as a human, I know that I can't really go back in time to that. That love deepens over time, but it also changes. And when I think about this as a metaphor for my relationship with God, I think, okay, wow, am I putting in the effort in my relationship with God that I know I have to put in with my spouse? That just like there are so many distractors and there is so much challenge that comes through with life, where am I holding in the attachment phase? If you've noticed, I've lowered the expectations a little bit from the Rambam. To me, it's something that is much more attainable than feeling lovesick for God, is feeling attached to God. Do I feel like God and I are partners? And I think that that's a question that when we look at Shir Shirim through the metaphor, that we need to ask ourselves. And if the answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no, that's already a good place. And I think that the question then is, well, where do I take it further from here? Where do I take it so that my relationship with God is present and it's healthy and I get angry and we have fights, but we also know how to recover from those fights. And I think that Shir HaShirim, in the way that Chazal envisioned it, encourages us to take some of our best lessons that we've learned about human relationships, human love relationships. If you need any suggestions, I have some great podcasts I listen to regularly, and to apply it to a relationship with God. I know for myself that there are not so infrequent days that I ignore him. Because to face him and to be honest would be very vulnerable, and I don't always have the energy. I could definitely say this has been true going through, I would say, some of the harder portions in my life up until this point, that there are days when you say, I don't really want to daven because I don't really want to talk to you. Because if I talk to you, then I'm going to start crying. And if I talk to you, then I'm going to be angry. And part of being healthily attached is being able to confront God and have a relationship that is consistent, that is dynamic, but that we're also able to maintain a connection. And I think that that's the metaphoric calling that Shir HaShirim has to offer us. We are at our end. I'm going to play one last song for those who could stay. Otherwise, please feel free to do whatever you need to do. I wanted to play this song last time. It's from Yishai Ribo. I'm not going to go through the words now. There are many words here taken from Shir Shirim. As I told you, Yishai Ribo is. I didn't play this last time, right? I wanted to, but I didn't get to it. Okay. And so he's just like the Shir Shirim king. And anyways, for those who understand his words, please read them and you can look him up online and hear more of his music.
כל דודין הזה בא, ככה מספרים להסיר את כל הרע ואת קרננו להרים מתוך תאומות אפר ולהקיץ נרדמים עם תרועת שופר כל דודין הזה בא, כך פשטה להשמועה וכל תינוק שנשבע קיבל את הנבואה אז בוא נצא לקראתו בטופים ועוגב שירו לו זמרו לו אשרי העם שהשם אלוקיו ואז יפוח היום והשקר יתהדר אז יצאו במחול כל איילות השדה וידלגו על הערים ולא מחמת אמה תשועלים ומחג והסלע יזרמו מים חיים בין סטרי המדרגה להשקות שושנת העמקים ולהקים משכן שיסיר את סבלותינו מכאן כל דודי דופק, פיתחו לי בניי הגיע זמן גאולתכם ולצרותכם אמרתי די ובאתי לבשר שלא תבכי יותר אחר מריחים את המשיח יותר מכל אבקת רוחל שלום לך דודי, הצח והאדמון שפוך חמתך על הבנים וישב לוי צרון ברחמים כי לרחמך אין זיכרון שיכיל את כל הנתונים ואז יפוח היום והשקר יתהדר אז יצאו במחול כל איילות השדה וידלגו ולא מחמת אמת השואלים ומחג והסלע יזרמו מים חיים בין סטרי המדרגה להשקות שושנת העמקים ולהקים משכן שיסיר את סבלותינו מכאן
Okay, I want to one last message before I'm happy to take any questions. I wanted just a moment. I'm sorry, I have a little bit unabashed publicity for myself. I'm hosting a new podcast, which We have two episodes are on Matan's website, but it'll be up on Spotify soon. So I would just say wait a few days. It'll be on Spotify and on iTunes. And it's called the Matan Podcast One-on-One, where the first series is I'm having conversations with women in Torah teaching and Torah learning about their personal journey into the world of Torah learning and teaching. At this point, it's mostly people who are connected to Matan. We have Yael Ziegler, Shani Tarrigan, Rabbi Malka Bina, Nechama Goldman Barish. Those are two that I did tape today. Tanya White, other people as well. It's going to be great. You can listen to two episodes on the Matan website, but it'll be up in a much more in an easier forum very soon. And so I'm just putting that out there, and we'll have more series. We're going to have other series. For now, it's going to be conversations between women. And I'm really excited about it. So I wanted just to share that. Feel free to check it out. I just want to thank you for a really wonderful experience, and I've loved seeing you. And I really wish everybody a Chag Sameach. And I hope that this has opened up everyone's mind and hearts a little bit, and gave you something to think about and take with you on the rest of your journey. So Chag Sameach, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Please feel free to unmute. Thanks for all the smileys and the hearts. Yeah.
A question about the song. What did Sach v'ha'admon mean?
Yeah. So the phrase, we didn't learn that poem because I was from three classes ago and I didn't get to it, but she describes the dod as tzach ve'adom, and there it refers to him being fresh. And there's a whole debate about what does it mean to be red. Again, it seems to be sort of, no, so not a gingy probably, but it has to do with in other places like rosy cheeks, like when it describes her as having cheeks that are like a rimon, because it's a sign of health. And so, but Ishe Ribo takes the word adom and he makes it into admon, which is from, if you remember from Ma'os Sur, where we say, I'm really bad at remembering words, but we say at the end, somebody help me because I can't remember things on the spot. At the end, because the word admon is a reference to the Mashiach, okay? And so he's using it, he's taking the word adom, but he makes it into admon, which he's there referring to Ma'os Sur, okay? And so he's describing God. Hine, thank you. The Chedmon, but said it's Almon. Sorry, I really am just so bad at remembering. So he takes that word there and he replaces it with the word Adam from Shir Shirim. Okay? So he's describing Mashiach. He's describing the ultimate redemption. He's taking, it's a strong metaphor song.
Beautiful song. Thank you so much. Thank you for the whole series. Thank you.
Pleasure, my pleasure. Thank you all. It's been really great. It's really been really great to meet you all.
Thank you so much. I wrote in the chat. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. It was so creative and fascinating. I love the way you blended everything together. If I wanted to sit down with Shir HaShirim and really start looking at it, what would you recommend as, what was one of your go-to mefarshim that you looked at?
Okay. Something that's in English, or can it be in Hebrew?
No, absolutely, be free, just fine.
Okay. So I think that I think as a place to start, basically, I would use Da'at Mikra. Da'at Mikra is
okay. That's the purples.
I don't know what color it is. Depends what edition, but there it's purple. Yeah, they're getting. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Okay. That one. So Amos Chacham is here on this one.
They used to have purples. They used to have purple bind thing around it, right?
Yeah. Okay. So what I will say that with Shir HaShirim, because it's poetry, the commentaries really are different. I mean, they're really different depending on what you're looking at. So the way that Amos Chacham will divide up the poems is totally different from the way that someone else will divide up the poems. So just take that into consideration, but it's a great place to start. He has, you know, helpful pictures to understand the different images. I think that, let me show you a picture. Hold on. I'll get it for you. Wait right there.
I'm not going anywhere. Okay.
I don't know where one gets a hold of this outside of Israel. Where are you speaking from?
Teaneck.
Okay, so I don't know. I'll tell you what, in English, if there is something that's like Feldheim or Art Scroll, I don't read that, so I won't know.
That's fine. That's
okay,
fine.
But because in English, the things that I read are academic, and they don't really prove for like a heartwarming read. So there are academic commentaries, but they really don't add any of an elevated level to Shir HaShirim. So I would say Amos Chacham is a great place to start. This book is, there's an academic version in English. I will tell you, if you write me an email, you can get it online in English. It's one of these websites that us academics stuck at home all year have been helped by, but I can't say that it's perfectly legal.
Okay.
So it's fine. The people who write know that it's up there. So this is a book by Eliyahu Assis. He was my advisor. It's Ahavat Olam
Ahavticha.
Okay. So that's a good book. And there's an English, more academic version that you can also get online. If it's called Flashes of Fire, but really send me an email. I'll write my email in again. I'm happy to
Great.
Send it. Hold on. I'm writing in the chat so I don't forget, because I will forget after. And this, I don't know if it came out yet for Shir HaShirim. I'm sure it will, because they're moving through the Megillot. But even just Stam is a great book. There's a series, it's called Perush Yisraeli Chadash. Okay, this is on Megillah, this is on Sefer Yonah. But there's also on
is that Avigdor Shinan and Zakovich?
Yeah.
I took classes with them at Hebrew U.
Okay, so that's their book. You know, they're at Tzemet Chemen.
Batman and Robin, yeah.
They're Batman and Robin, exactly. And Yair Zakovich just got Pras Yisrael.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this,
other I don't stuff know if, by them.
I don't know if they have on Shir HaShirim, but this is this is a great commentary for the very educated layperson. Which you guys are all very educated. I've gotten very detailed emails with very important corrections. So everybody here is very educated. So I don't know if they have in Shir HaShirim, because I haven't been into a bookstore in about a year, but if they do, then I would
amazing. So many of us.
Okay. So that's what I would start with. I personally, you're seeing my library that's now on my bed. This series.
Oh, that's part of a whole series.
Yeah. Okay. So you know how some people get like a bracelet for their wedding? So I asked my parents to buy me this. I have the whole series. My husband as our wedding gift. He'll deny it. He's very embarrassed about it. But he's like, how did not you get your jewelry? He got me the set of Midrash Rabbah. Okay. I have to tell you, I'm still 10 years later. I'm still very happy. I don't want the bracelet. It's fine. I have a bracelet here that my mom got me. It's good enough. So anyways, this series of Olam HaTanach is a not from version of Da'at Mikra for the general audience. It's not a particularly inspiring commentary, but it's very good if you're trying to understand things deeper, but it's based on academic
archaeology.
It's more than that. It's also, it's very biblically critical, meaning it's source criticism. This Shir HaShirim doesn't have any source criticism. It's not
right.
There isn't that topic. The most chilul you'll get with Shir HaShirim is that it's
literal.
A set of ancient poems, and that it means nothing else. But if you're looking to understand the psukim themselves, then this is a great place to start. Some of the volumes are better than others. It is a whole set. You can sometimes take it out from like a library somewhere. I don't know about in Teaneck, but I use it for most things as one of my many things that I'll read. But
in your toolkit.
Yeah, in my toolkit. I'm sure there's other stuff out there. I also just read a lot of articles. And also another thing is there's just some really good websites. I would look at HaTanach website, which is KH at the end. It's mom, you have to stop complimenting me in the comments. It's
HaTanach.org.
HaTanach.org or .co.il. If you just type in HaTanach, type like
it'll finish.
And it's Michal Herzog's website, which every page on the website you can also get in English. The English is sometimes stilted, but like it's all translated. And if you just click on Shir, if you you'll see you can browse by book, and if you click on Shir Shirim and pick any perek, and then you'll see on the left side there's like it says articles or whatever you or commentaries. Sorry, click on articles, and if you click on any article at the bottom of it, you'll see a web, and in the web you'll see related articles. So it won't be something you can use to read the whole book from beginning to end. That I would use a commentary, but I don't know because I haven't checked it for Shir Shirim, but I'm sure that they have articles in Shir Shirim. I'm sure they have some stuff there by Yael, and there'll be both audio Shirim that are taped, and there'll also be things that have been typed up, and you can also learn like that.
That could be another year.
Exactly. There's so many years. There's been so many years and so many more years. So we always have time. There's a lot of great series on that. There's also a lot of great series on the VBM, which is like the the brother, right? The brother of HaTanakh. So the VBM has good series on Tanakh, most of which have been translated from the Hebrew. So those are also really helpful. Hope that helped.
Thank you. That was great.
If you find anything else good, I'm happy to hear. I'm not as updated, certainly not in English. So
I can read it in Hebrew too. Lo chashuv.
No, I know. I know you can.
Thank you.
I'm also always
happy. Thank you so much. Thank
My
you.
Pleasure. Okay, well, it's been a real pleasure. And
thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yosefa, do you have room for one more question?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, so back in the first poem with, and then ki aza kamavet ahava. Did you ever consider translating aza as brazen? Brazen and kasha as tough, that the ahava is there's a chutzpah to it, like she says, I want you to put your chotem on your, like wear it on your sleeve. Mm-hmm. And somehow that's and the Sheol also brings up that image of Euripides going, challenging Hades to bring back his beloved. Mm-hmm. So that ahava can even transcend death. It is so brazen that it can challenge death.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, again, there are a lot of different interpretations offered for these verses because everyone is struggling with how to understand the correlation between the images with one another, which is stronger, which is mightier, which is destructive, which is not destructive. But I think that's also definitely a possibility. I would have to look deeper into the usage of the word of the root for oz to see mm-hmm. if any of it means to go against something or to, as you said, to be brazen.
Like oz kanamer.
Yes, but that also kind of there, yeah. I don't know if it's brazen as much as it has to do with strength, but or might, but yeah, I would have to look more into that. But I think it's definitely a possibility. Yeah, there's something there that's chutzpahdik about that love in a good way.
That it can conquer death, like it can transcend death. Yeah,
which is of course, by the way, another way to say that is we could still love people even if they're not alive.
Yeah,
I think that's what it's getting at. It's not getting at the dead loving because we don't know that, but it's speaking about the fact that we have a spouse or a parent or a sibling and we still have love in our hearts for them even when they're not here.
Yeah,
I think that's okay. Very much in that sentence.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody.
Bye
bye.